CR, everyone. I'm Emmeline Pat Dahlstrom from Space Base, a social enterprise focused on catalyzing the aerospace entrepreneurial ecosystem in New Zealand to solve challenges on Earth and beyond. You're listening to the Space Base podcast. Today, I'm interviewing Gary Friedman. Gary is founder and CEO of Electric Air, a clean aviation company bringing electric flight to New Zealand. He's worked for green energy companies like Ecotricity, the very first green energy company in the world. In this interview, we're going to talk about Gary's personal journey from clean and sustainable energy to sustainable aviation and his role in bringing the first electric airplane to New Zealand. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks again for agreeing to be in the Space Base podcast. So let's just start from your early years. Before your current focus on electric planes, you worked a lot in green energy. Was it something you were really interested or passionate about from an earlier age? What was the motivation?
Yeah, absolutely. I've always been interested in the way that energy's made, where it comes from. And I had this kind of, I suppose it was a bit of a nerdy interest in some ways in the technology, but I was never an engineer. So I could never, you know, I was never going to be the sort of person who is inventing a wind turbine or a solar panel, and never going to be the person who is physically installing these things with a spanner. But what I did have was a commercial acumen and an interest in environmental issues. And so the two kind of came together. In fact, I always struggle to describe if someone says, what was your job title really? The nearest I could ever find was sort of hybrid manager. So what I mean by that is, you know, I'm not the garage mechanic, but I know what a spanner does. So right. I've always been the person who sort of brought together the latest technology in renewable energy and then applied that to a market need and implemented that. So yeah, I spent more than a couple of decades in the predominantly development of wind farms, and then in more recent years, solar farms and solar technology for industrial customers.
And if we go back like even earlier, I think you actually were born and raised in the UK, is that correct?
I was actually, funnily enough, I was actually born in Cape Town in South Africa, but I was only seven when we moved to the UK. So yeah, really grew up in the UK, and most of my working life has been in the UK. The development of that part of my career was all in the UK for green energy companies predominantly and renewable energy companies, and yeah, it was the usual met a Kiwi over there, and she was from Christchurch here in New Zealand. And I eventually gave in, and we moved here a few years ago. Much my pleasure now. I'm feeling quite smug, especially with the with the pandemic at the moment. But yeah, I got into it initially. The idea started. This is going back now about 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Where you could actually produce electricity from a renewable source instead of from a fossil fuel source, and then make a link to the end customer. And that was what we would call the green energy tariff. And it might seem like an obvious thing now, but back then it was really novel. So we just thought, well, hold on, we're installing, you know, a wind farm somewhere in Britain, on or offshore, and the customer has no real connection to that emotionally or commercially. And so we sort of said, well, what happens if we said to them, look, you can switch from a dirty tariff to a clean energy tariff. And so that's kind of how I got into the industry on that sort of side of things. And that grew quite quickly, and other companies started adopting that model. But I think, yeah, Ecotricity, this is the UK Ecotricity, were the first in the world, as far as I know, to do that for commercial customers. And then later that opened to domestic. But actually the part of the thing that I did that I was probably most proud of and interested in was something that we called merchant wind power. So this is where we would, rather than a big wind farm out in, you know, on farmland somewhere in the countryside, we would actually go and find industrial customers who had large electricity needs on site. And we would install large, full, you know, grown up wind turbines on those sites. And the customer would then take the power from those wind turbines directly behind the meter. And that meant they cut out their lines charges and they got cheaper electricity and obviously greener. And that was a real tipping point, I think, in people's understanding that renewable energy was not a technology that they couldn't see. And it also was not a technology that was expensive. In fact, what was happening was these customers were massively reducing the fossil fuels that they were buying through the grid and having cheaper, greener electricity on their own locations. So they were saving money, they were greening up. And the other thing about the wind turbines is that there's this massive green signpost, if you like, at these sites saying we are green. So it was great, actually. In fact, it works better than solar, because you can the wind is so visible, you know, 120 meter wind turbine on your car park, you're not going to miss.
So I'm curious, the company that you were with was really like first in the world. What was the challenges of influencing or getting those first customers to really buy into the idea, because it's fairly new and, you know, it goes against the tradition and the regular things that most companies would do?
Yeah, no, look, I'm really attracted to that idea of going first, but it's always, you know, the stupidest, hardest thing to do. You know, coming second is much easier. Just following someone else and doing it better, you know, which is kind of, you know, the Apple kind of idea. But and you know, you will come onto the plane, which is a first here. But no, I think initially the main challenge we always faced was in planning consent. Because wind turbines are large, and so they have a visual impact. Although the noise from wind turbines is nowhere like, you know, anti-wind people like to say, you know, there still is a swishing sound. So you need to find the right locations, and so there was always protests about that. There was always, or often, there may be issues from bird or ecology organisations. Although, funnily enough, later on, one of the deals that I put together was for the RSPB, which was the main bird protection society in the UK, and they actually installed a wind turbine at their main base, and that was a really great moment, actually. So look, lots of challenges in those terms, but I would say that from a customer perspective, they saw the benefits. I think, you know, the companies who were starting to really realize at that time, you know, 10 to 20 years ago, that they had to do something to clean up their emissions, were looking at what options existed. And if you think about it, there was, you know, there's LED light bulbs and better refrigeration and that kind of thing. But, you know, ultimately, as you can only be so efficient, you still need energy. And but if you could change the way that energy was made, that was an enormous impact on their carbon reduction targets. So businesses were very attracted to it for those three reasons, really, which was, like I said, the visual signpost, it's kind of PR, if you like, reducing their emissions and reducing them and budgeting costs. So those three things came together really well with on-site renewable energy generation. And it's the same now with as the cost of solar has reduced so much in more recent years. That's what we started doing. It's the same sort of model, but with solar.
I'm also curious, how long is the time frame for flipping over from fossil fuel to wind? If you have a customer, for example, how long would it take to get that running where they're actually getting the benefit and seeing the benefits?
Yeah, well, the average time period for getting a large scale wind project going in the UK grew every year, just took longer and longer and longer. And that was to do with purely and only to do with the planning consent process just being very difficult and becoming harder and harder as we went along. So at the beginning, funnily enough, it was quicker. It was always easier on an industrial site than in a greenfield site because for obvious reasons, you know, it's an industrial setting. So we quite like putting wind turbines next to motorways, highways, you know, busy roads, industrial areas, ports, that kind of thing, because it was easier. It fitted into the background better, and there was higher ambient noise anyway, so the noise wasn't really a problem, and ecology wasn't so much of an issue because there was struggling to find any living natural thing around these industrial sites. But still these projects would take, you know, in the order of years, not months, because of that process. One other thing that reminds me of when you talk about the time frames is when I looking back now in the UK, when I remember starting in the industry in, I think it was about 2000, 2001, and there was, I think, about 3% or 4% of the UK's electricity generation came from renewable sources, which was basically very, very old hydro stations. And there was lots of talk that you could never go beyond 10% with renewables because of the fluctuation, you know, wind doesn't always blow, sun doesn't always shine, and it would be impossible and the grid wouldn't be able to cope. And then we watched over the, you know, the coming years as wind farms started springing up, and we went past 5%, 6%, 10% past, you know, no issues. And in fact, the national grid to control the grid infrastructure always said it wasn't a problem. And then it's gone, you know, to 15%, then past 20%. And I think it was a couple of weeks ago, I read that there was a day in the UK recently where more than half of the energy came purely from wind. That's not even solar, just wind. So 52%, I think. And Scotland regularly has days like that where the majority of their energy comes from wind, and often they're an exporter to England. So yeah, it's really nice to look back now at the naysayers and you know, said it can't be done, and to see how that greens up. And you know, it's why all this electrification of transport is so interesting, because the electric car or electric plane is energy agnostic, and it doesn't care where its energy comes from. But as our grids get greener, so do those electric vehicles and electric things that we're using.
Great. Before I go and ask questions about electric air, I want to actually go even further back to your motivation as a kid or earlier on in your life. Why are you focused on green energy? Was there something that you were really passionate about when you were young that is related to either the environment is important, or I'm just like trying to understand where that motivation came from?
Yeah, no, look, it's a really good question, actually. The earliest I can remember was being in the car with my dad and becoming aware that there was a thing called an exhaust pipe. I was a kid, you know, a little kid, an exhaust pipe. And I was like, what's that for? And, you know, what comes out of that? And then kind of being aware of really from the pollution side of things. That's how it started. And, you know, later on, they started introducing catalytic converters, which were meant to make the exhaust pipe cleaner. And I was thinking, oh, yeah, that seems sensible. And that's obviously the solution. And then realizing that, oh, no, that's just a tiny, you know, step. Surely we need to do more. I think it was that. And the other thing probably was smoking, not me smoking, but I always hated smoking, and that, like, this idea, and like, I always got very I was always very sensitive to people smoking around me, and I was thinking, like, this is really an odd thing to do, and you know, I don't want to really be in a room with you, this is terrible. And then you'd go out in you know, I was living in London, and you'd go out in the streets there, or you'd go on the underground, and you'd come home, and you could feel, like, in your nose and in your lungs, you could almost feel like you've had that's like being down a coal mine for the day. And it was it was really that got me into it. Like, I just felt that this can't be right, that we are subjecting ourselves to these levels of pollution, whether it's through smoking or exhaust pipes or through energy generation, because we were generating energy from, you know, coal, oil and gas. And so I think that's what got me interested. It probably came, you know, I've never really thought about it, to be honest. That's a good question. But it probably would have come from a health perspective more than planetary at the beginning. And then I guess as I started growing up, realizing the impacts on the ecosystem, and then much later, climate change. I don't think it was a term that I was aware of until a lot later.
Yeah, thanks for the insight. So going now more into current times, when did you start flying? Or were you flying? How did that came about?
Oh, I got into hang gliding as a university student there was a hang gliding club, and you sort of walk into these things kind of not fully knowing what you're doing. And I became aware of this hang gliding club. So I was like, oh, that sounds fun. So joined up to that and started doing a bit of hang gliding training, which involved running down hills with a couple of instructors tethering ropes to the side of the wing. And you've got airborne for maybe 30 seconds and then a minute, and then they take the tethers off, and then you get airborne for maybe a little bit longer, and then you realize that, well, with the right conditions, you can start using ridge lift and soaring the hills and then using thermals and going higher. And I got absolutely addicted to hang gliding, and I did that for a long time. And it was a sport that took me to the French Alps every year. There was a group of us that would drive down from the UK, 12 hours. I think we'd normally do it overnight or leave very early in the morning, ferry over to France, drive down to the French Alps. And then we would set up a camp at this campsite in right in the middle of the mountains, and at the bottom in the valley. And we'd set up our tents, and for 2 weeks we would just wake up, load all our gear into some big cars, drive up a mountain, and spend the day flying every day. And then on a good day, you might cover a lot of ground, maybe 100 kilometers or something, or out and across country, and either then try and get back and land in the campsite next to your tent where there'd always be a cold beer waiting, or sometimes we would go off on a cross-country flight and land in some valley you'd never been to or never heard of. And in those days we were just on paper maps. We certainly weren't using GPSs with maps on them. Even if we had a GPS, it would just be it would just give you the grid coordinate. And we would just land in a field somewhere, hopefully in one piece, sometimes not, and then with handheld radios try and communicate with your friends where you'd got to. And then every day one person would have to be the driver, and then they'd spend hours and hours driving around the French countryside looking for these different hang gliders. And we'd often get back at 2 o'clock in the morning back to our tent, because we'd been picking people up from all over the place, and then stop and have a late dinner somewhere in a lovely little French town or village. It was great. So we did that really occupied me for years, and flew in the States and in Australia and in New Zealand and all over the UK. And it was a sport that was always kept its learning curve, because even if you were going back to the same site to fly, the weather was always different. So there's always a different challenge. There'd be different air traffic, different considerations, different times of year. So hang gliding was really, I think it's a tremendous introduction into flying, because you really understand what's happening in the air. Again, it's kind of a bit of environmental awareness as well. You're really thinking about the conditions. You're looking at weather patterns. It's you're much more connected to the weather and clouds and wind and all that kind of stuff than with a powered aircraft. And so for years and years I loved hang gliding, and then we had a couple of children, and we had a couple of little kids, and I was still flying, but actually the time involved in hang gliding is always a problem, because it's always a day. You can't go and just have a quick flight. It's load your gear up, spend hours looking at the weather, spend hours driving to a site, rigging, sitting on the mountain for hours, which I used to love when you had no responsibilities. And then it was what time are you home? And you're like, well, I'm just waiting for the westerly to pick up, or for the cloud to lift, or whatever it was. And it just became a really difficult sport to try and do. And I think I just got to a point after nearly 20 years, I think, where I realized that it was time to maybe hang up the wing for a bit. But like so many ex hang glider pilots, the gear sits in your shed or in your garage for years, and you're in denial, thinking, I'll do that again, and it's getting moldy with spider webs all over it. I did stop flying for a couple of years, but there wasn't a day that I didn't look up and think, what's the weather doing? I could be up there. There's a good field to land in. I'd like to run off that mountain. You know, it never goes away when you get that passion. So it was just really, and I would actually call it an addiction. I really think flying for me is an addiction. And then what happened was, after a couple of years out of the game, a lot of my friends were going into microlighting and light aircraft. People from the hang gliding world, you know, just getting to a certain age and just had enough of it, was just becoming too hard. And so I relented and went along to get some flying lessons in microlights and light aircraft. And so probably that was probably about 5 or 6 years ago. So I started flying the planes, and yeah, I've been enjoying that ever since. And, you know, it had a couple of, they do have some advantages, aeroplanes. You know, one, you can go places in them, so that's quite nice. So the flying is much less exciting than a hang glider, but you can go from A to B. And the second thing is, you've got a spare seat next to you. So, you know, you can take up your kids or your friends or your family, and it's quite nice to be able to have others come with you and enjoy that experience and go to different locations. So yeah, that's the flying story.
Oh, that's awesome. And so how did your focus on green energy and your work in green energy led to electric air, essentially?
Yeah, so it was things coming together, and it was just logical. I was driving an electric car in the UK and had become really aware of the benefits of EVs and just electrification of vehicles, to a point where I was kind of amazed that what electric cars could do, even in the early days. They were so much better than I had understood, and it was so much more important than I understood. And I just, you know, in the UK, remember, at the, even now, it's still the minority of energy is generated from renewable energy sources. But what I hadn't understood was that even if you had a grid which was 100% dirty fossil fuel, it would still be much greener and much better to drive an electric vehicle than a piston engine vehicle, because of the efficiencies of the motor. So with an electric motor, you're talking about efficiencies around 95%, and with a combustion engine, you're somewhere hovering around 20-25%. So even if you took you know, a coal grid and drove in an electric vehicle, that would be better than driving a petrol car. And but as I said earlier, as the grid becomes greener, so does that vehicle. And in the UK at that time, we were probably heading towards about 20% renewables. And so driving an electric car made absolute sense. And then you had the second point, which is that there's no pollution out of the exhaust pipe, so it's a win-win. And as the grid gets greener, so do electric vehicles. So I was driving happily and passionately driving electric cars. And I remember rocking up to the airfield one day to go for a fly. I was on my own, and I got there and I pulled out the plane from the hangar. I thought, hang on a minute, this is crazy. Like, my hobby now is not hang gliding. It's now flying in a petrol plane, and that's not good enough. So I thought it can't be that hard to electrify a small plane. And I started doing the research, and I looked around and realized that there was a lot of developers, in early stages of electric plane projects. But the one that really stood out was Pipistrel in Slovenia. Now, they're a manufacturer who's been around for years. They've been making gliders and small petrol aeroplanes. And they had produced some of the most efficient light aircraft in the world. They won several NASA awards for efficiency. So they do... there's different measures for their awards. But effectively you would do something, for example, like how far can you fly at a certain speed on a gallon of petrol, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so they'd won several NASA awards for that. And they really stood out for me as a manufacturer who was just thinking differently. And they had produced a prototype and even an early production electric plane, which was called the Pipistrel Alpha Electro. And so I just knew I had to go and see this thing, and headed out to Slovenia. We went to the factory, and Ivo Boscarol, who's the founder of the company, took me. I just thought we'd have a look around the factory and I'd see the plane. But he was like, "Right, let's go out to the runway," and he had a plane there, electric plane there, waiting. And at the time, more people had been in space than had been in an electric plane. This was in 2016. And it was fantastic. In fact, I sat in the passenger seat and seat belted up and closed the cockpit door. And I was thinking, I have to record this. This is incredible. I've got to video this. And I was looking down at my video camera and getting things, you know, ready, and looked up and we were moving. It was so quiet, and there's almost no pre-flight check. So you just sort of get in, pop a few switches up, as you know, and, away you go. We probably had maybe a, 20 minute flight. And when we landed, I just knew from that moment on that I had to help push this technology forwards. And I was, in the same way that I'd watched the electric vehicle movement and hadn't probably appreciated just how good and how important that was at the beginning. And I was a bit late to that. Early by most people's standards, but in 2016, after that flight, I just realized that it had to be done. I had to do something with electric planes.
Oh, that's great. And how hard was it for you to bring the Alpha Electro to New Zealand as the first plane?
Yeah, so we moved to New Zealand. We'd lived here before. We came back for permanently now, and a few years ago. And first thing I did was I started speaking to pilots. I just thought, let's actually do a little bit of market research. And I was almost afraid to bring up the subject in the club room. You just think old miserable blokes sitting around, being very conservative and. This is how we've always done it, and there's we know how to maintain our engine. But actually, that wasn't the attitude I got at all. It was actually the opposite. Everyone agreed that it was a sensible technology, that it was the way forward, it was the future, and the feedback I got was so positive. It drove me forwards to thinking, right, we've got to do this. And I was very focused on New Zealand being the place to bring the plane to, because we've got such a green grid, and because flying is so important to people here. I mean, it's a small country. We've got the highest rate of short haul flights per capita in the world. Our network is well set up for it. We've got lots of small runways, so it was the place to do it. And then the attitude from pilots was so good. And so, how hard was it? It was very hard. We needed to raise capital, and we also needed to persuade the regulator that it was something that was sensible to be doing here, flying electric planes. So that's the Civil Aviation Authority. And so we set about on both those tracks. And one of the first people we went to was Christchurch City Council, which is where I'm based, and they have a fund called the Innovation and Sustainability Fund. And we met some tremendous people actually at the city council, Vicky Buck and Kevin Crutchley and others. And they were really supportive of this, because what they realized is that Christchurch, which is still in a rebuild phase after the earthquakes of 2010 and 11, we're looking for innovation, job creation, education. And as you know, from the space side of things, it's recognized now as one of the central nodes of growth. So they saw this as being a really interesting area where, because it's sustainable from an environmental perspective, but also long-term sustainability, it has a huge interest from an educational perspective and also from an engineering perspective. And you could just see a path, a kind of future path there. And they wanted to help. So they came on board the Christchurch City Council in terms of some grant funding, which was helpful, but also just as being a partner and a name that we could say, look, we're not alone now. Yeah. And they also, they own part of Christchurch International Airport, and Christchurch Airport. So they introduced us at the from the top to the airport, and we got on well there, and they were happy that we could fly from Christchurch Airport. And later, talk about it later, but they were have helped with charging infrastructure for the aircraft and some other things. And then Airways, who control the airspace, were really interested in this because they obviously see that as the future, and especially for young pilots coming through with training. So they've been very supportive as well. And we also brought on board from the energy side, Meridian Energy, as a partner and as a sponsor, because we wanted the energy that went into the plane to be associated with companies that only generate from renewable energy sources, which Meridian do. So so those partners were important, and then we attracted some private investors to come in, and we raised the capital to bring the aeroplane here to New Zealand. And then the other battle's been, you know, with the regulator, but because we had to get this thing certified into a category. Mm. And you know, with new technology, it's always challenging, but they already had some interesting technology that they were dealing with, like Whisk, the Cora, the Kitty Hawk Cora, and other autonomous vehicles and drones and that sort of stuff. So it wasn't like this was the most strange vehicle for them to certify, but it was still something to deal with, where they couldn't just tick a box because of the propulsion. So there's been a lot of challenges, and you know, we still are going through some challenges, but the plane is here. It arrived in February, March 2020, almost, you know, with perfect timing for the virus outbreak and the lockdown. So we took it out of the shipping container, put the thing together, because you put the wings on and a few other bits, and put it in the hangar. And then we're in lockdown. And it was the most frustrating thing to have this new toy here that I've been dreaming about for 4 years, right, and couldn't even drive, weren't even allowed to drive to the airfield to see it, let alone fly it. So yeah, it's been a interesting and a challenging journey, but it's here now, and it's great.
Wow. And so what is your plans? What are your goals for the next maybe 5 years for electric air?
Yeah, so I suppose this, I always think of it as two things. So one is that we are determined to encourage the growth of low emission aviation. I say low emission rather than, you know, battery electric, because I don't care if that's hydrogen or battery or whatever it is, or, you know, there's a range of things we must do to bring emissions down in aviation. And I suppose the way I look at it is from this aeroplane's perspective, it's really a demonstrator. So I want people to see it. I want people to come and fly in it. By people, I mean both pilots and non-pilots, particularly flight schools. I think it's important that they come and see this. And I want them to be challenged. I want the flight schools to feel a bit of pressure on themselves, you know, from themselves, to say, well, what is the next aeroplane we're going to purchase, you know, in our fleet for this flight school? Is it going to be another old Cessna or Piper or Tecnam, or what, you know, what's it going to be? Or, you know, are we going to stop and think, can we introduce initially a electric plane into the fleet? And it doesn't need to be radical. You know, if you've got 20 planes in your flight school, we're saying, well, why isn't one of those now, when you need to replace that plane, why isn't that one electric? Because with a plane like our Pipistrel Alpha Electro, it can fly for an hour with about half an hour reserve. And that's perfect for 90% of the training flights for your ab initio student up to PPL or microlight pilot rating. Mm-hmm. Because those lessons are all under an hour, as you know, you've done some pilot training. And then when you get to maybe some of the cross-country flights where the aircraft requirements, the mission is for more than an hour, yes, you will need to jump into a petroplane at the moment. But by the time, you know, they've integrated, you know, one plane into the mix, and then the duration increases, and, you know, in a few years' time, we'll be seeing planes that can certainly handle all the training needs for all the pilots. And New Zealand's a worldwide recognised centre of excellence for pilot training, for commercial pilot training. And I think if we add on to that sustainability, you know, we really do have a unique advantage. We've got, you know, an empty airspace, relatively, a green grid, and people with great skills. You know, we've got fantastic training schools and instructors in New Zealand. So all we have to do is add in the technology, and the technology's here. So I suppose to answer your question a bit more succinctly, from the plane point of view, from our first plane, this is a demonstrator to encourage others. But the plane's also, the plane now is available for people to come and see. You know, if people want to have a trial flight, they should get in touch. And later this year, we want to use the plane for training as well. So offer that, both Microlite and PPL training. But over the next few years, what we're quite excited about is a couple of things. One is we think there's an opportunity for electric retrofit. So that means taking electric propulsion and actually putting that into combustion engine designed planes.
Right.
And it's not as bonkers as it sounds. It's not as bonkers as, or difficult even, as changing a car engine
right.
for an electric version. Because with your car, it could be driven for maybe 20 years. You know, you do your 500,000 kilometers or whatever it is, and then there's no way you're going to replace the engine at that point. You know, the engine goes and you throw it away. But with these aeroplanes, with combustion engine aeroplanes, every 2,000 hours, you're changing the engine.
Right.
Every 2,000 hours is not a lot of time. So flight schools are changing their engines every 2 or 3 years, commonly. Yeah. And that's an expensive and time-consuming process. Common and not difficult, but, you know, your plane's out of service. You spend a lot of money putting a new engine in, and then away you go again. And then in 2,000 hours, you're replacing right. that engine. So the point is, every few years, you're replacing these components anyway. So why not, at that next change, pop in an electric motor and some batteries? There are lots of challenges to that. So the main one at the moment from a technology point of view is, you know, is battery capacity and density. But also there's a regulatory question as well about that. So there's a process you'd have to follow, but it's all doable. So that's one of our goals, and one of the things we're looking into and progressing on some fronts. So we've done some work with University of Canterbury already on looking at some of the feasibility of which aircraft are most suitable for that, and some analysis of where battery technology is. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is we'd like to increase the fleet, electric fleet. So if we're not seeing other training schools taking that up and adopting that, we'll have to do that ourselves. And I suppose the third thing and the big goal is to see short haul passenger flights replaced with battery electric planes. And that's something that we would like to be involved with. And we're looking at that very carefully at the moment, at the developments around the world of 10 to 20 seat electric planes.
Well, that's awesome. That's an awesome vision. And segues really well with my other question, that if you think of it on a global scale, at least you personally, how do you see the aerospace industry growing, like in the next decade, for example? Are we going to see, you know, electric planes and jets replacing conventional airplanes? And when would we be having flying cars, for example?
I know, we all want a flying car. We've got flying boats. That's been one of the big developments in the industry, that Magnix have put these electric motors in seaplanes in Canada and Vancouver. And actually, you've converted over a Cessna Caravan in the States as well. And there's some work going on in Sydney with that as well. So what we're seeing is the retrofitting of, you know, up to 9-10 seat planes from a feasibility point of view, you know, with this good research going on there, on the one hand. And on the other, in parallel, the other development that's occurring is new aircraft from ground up, new fully electric aircraft from ground up. And, you know, that's clearly where it's going to go, because you design the plane to be very light with composite materials, and it's designed straight away thinking about electric, and that's always going to be better and more efficient. And the really interesting thing about electric motors versus standard combustion engines is that you can put these motors anywhere. You can chuck them along a wing. You know, you've seen some NASA designs with, you know, multi prop on the wing. It can be on the wing tip, it can be on the back, the front. You can put them anywhere, because your batteries are wherever they are. You don't need to be next to it. And you've got these tiny motors that are driving the prop. So from a design perspective, it's really an innovative time in the new plane world. I think that's very, very interesting space. And there's at least 100 companies out there who are developing things from scratch. And it's, you know, we do see some of them standing out, like Eviation in Israel, Israeli company who's developed a, I think that's carrying nine passengers, I think. And, you know, some of the stats they're talking about are really impressive, you know, getting to a few hundred kilometer range and, you know, that number of passengers. But the problem for these developers is often not technical constraints, but regulatory. So to get these aircraft certified is will take longer than actually developing from a whiteboard to a prototype to serial production. And so you're really needing deep pockets. And companies like that need to be very well funded and have patience. And, you know, there's we've just seen some really big funding announcements for a company in the UK, Zero Avia, who are developing some hydrogen technology. And they've just received some really good, impressive funding, including from Jeff Bezos of Amazon fame. So they are getting attention and it will happen. But when exactly is hard to say. My prediction is that by the end of this decade, so the 2020s, we will have we'll certainly have up to 10 seat fully electric planes flying and certified and taking passengers. That will happen. And I'm hopeful up to 19, 20 seats as well in this decade. And in fact, I would say by the end of by the late 2020s, we'll certainly be flying in up to 20 seat fully electric planes. And Pipistrel themselves have well into the development of a 19 seat aircraft in conjunction with Chinese partner that's been developed in China. And there's many other examples. Sounds Air recently announced a memorandum of understanding with Heart Aerospace, which is a Scandinavian manufacturer who are developing a really good looking plane as well. But look, it's definitely challenging. And I would say beyond the 10 to 20 seat space, we're really struggling at the moment. And the only way it's going to happen is through hybrid technology. So a combination of combustion, fossil fuel and electric. And we will definitely see in aeroplanes, we're going to see hybrid solutions for a long time. We're still seeing them in cars. And I've got a lot of sympathy for why we had to have a stepping stone of hybrid technology in cars. And we will have to have that for larger aeroplanes, even the 20 seats. Some of those are going to be hybrid technology. And there's good efficiencies you can get through that. Obviously, I would, from my environmental perspective, would like to see fully electric. But we're going to see a bit of a combination. There was a really interesting project where they took from, I think it was a BAE 146, might have that wrong, but it was a four jet plane, and they replaced one of the jets with a 2 megawatt electric motor, massive, filled the fuselage with batteries, and that's flown. And then the idea is you then replace a second jet engine with a motor. And then you have this hybrid situation where you've got two fossil fuel jet propulsion units and two electric. So things like that are happening, and there's a lot of research and development. But yeah, so to answer your question in terms of what we're going to be flying in, definitely this decade, 10 to 20 seaters, fully electric, and then very soon after that, hybrid alternatives, and then it will grow and grow.
Well, that's awesome to look forward to, for sure. Pretty amazing. So going back to the electric air, as you mentioned, I was very privileged to be able to fly as a passenger student. And it's pretty amazing. So I guess just to reiterate what you mentioned, if anybody who's listening right now would be interested in taking either a flight or a lesson, what's the best way to contact you?
Our website has all the details. That's electricair.nz, electricair.nz, or you can contact us by email at info@electricair.nz, and we can go from there. But certainly we're interested in hearing from anyone who wants to see the plane or fly in the plane, because that's really why it's here. We're a social enterprise company, and our goal with this first aircraft is to just get as much visibility as possible And for, I think you were actually one of the first passengers to fly in an electric plane in New Zealand.
So which was fantastic. I mean, it's awesome.
Yeah, because you've got quite a bit of experience flying, you know, traditional, you know, Cessnas or Pipers or whatever. How different was it for you?
Oh, it was just like so smooth that there's no noise and it's so stable. I mean, you can't even stall it, basically. So yeah, it's just pretty amazing.
Yeah, glad you enjoyed it. Yeah, no, that's excellent. Yeah, we haven't really even mentioned the benefits of noise reduction. But yeah, I mean, it's quiet when you're in the cockpit, but the really big advantage is for the person on the ground. You know, if you're living near an airport or aerodrome, electric planes have this huge advantage. They're so quiet. I mean, you know, 1,000 feet or more, you really can't hear them. So yeah, that's the other big benefit. And I think that people will cotton on to that.
Yeah. So my last set of questions essentially is asking normally for resources. And so just wanted to get from you if you have any favorite resources about either electric planes, aerospace, just anything that you'd like to share with the audience.
Maybe slightly off topic, but still in the same area. My favorite YouTube channel is Fully Charged. And I think they've got a website. I think it's fullycharged.show, something like that. But it's just a very interesting, enthusiastic look at predominantly EVs, electric vehicles, but they do cover aviation a bit. And but they also cover renewable energy developments and actually some really unusual technologies that are happening in the space. So I never miss an episode of Fully Charged. They normally put out a couple of episodes a week on YouTube, and they also have a podcast as well, a Fully Charged podcast. So that's always my go-to. And it was really from Fully Charged that I actually realized this concept about the amount of energy that it takes to refine a gallon of oil. So when you think about the petrol in your car, the figures you always see for the CO2 is, you know, how much the car burns. But, you know, if you think back to the refining of that oil, how many kilowatt hours per gallon or whatever it takes, that's really interesting. So, yeah, things like that. I quite like that as a resource.
Awesome. So before we close, do you have any other parting words for aerospace enthusiasts in New Zealand that might want to pursue similar career paths that you have?
Yeah, well, I would think that this is definitely, you can be absolutely guaranteed it's a growing space. So, you know, there's not many things in the, you know, in the world in economics that you could say this is going to grow for absolutely for sure. You know, I wouldn't, you know, it's, you know, Bitcoin or something may grow, it may fall or whatever, it goes up. But you know that electric vehicles are going one way. You know, we are going to have electric cars and we're going to have electric planes. So if someone's starting out in their career or is working in aerospace or in aviation and wants to, you know, sustainability in their career and sustainability environmentally, electric planes are a great place to be. Electric aviation, it's going to happen. You know, we need charging infrastructure. We need to think about how that's going to work. We need licensed maintenance engineers who are trained in electric propulsion. We need people who understand batteries and those developments. So yeah, it's a really good space to be in. If I was an engineering student or something, this is definitely an area I'd look in. You know, in Christchurch, we've got the engine center that looks after Pratt & Whitney engines. You know, that's going to be, okay, COVID aside, it's going to be, you know, we're going to need to look after, and you know, jet engines for a long time. But if you're thinking, what's the next area of that we're going to have to look after, it's like, well, who in New Zealand knows how to service and look after electric motors or batteries, or, you know, be experts there. And I would say that there's a huge opportunity in the area.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Gary, for sharing your thoughts and insights to the New Zealand community and beyond. Thanks for participating in the podcast.
Oh, it's great to speak to you. Come for another flight anytime.
I will, hopefully. To our audience, thank you for listening to the podcast. If you like our work and would like to support us, please check us out at spacebase.co. Thanks for listening and see you next time.